Okay, so today what I'm going to do is I'm going to continue to discuss the diagonalization of square matrices, but today the emphasis is going to be on when we can actually diagonalize a matrix. So I showed you how to, but there was a caveat involved in that. I'll review that stuff to start with, and then we'll look at specific ways you can tell whether or not a matrix is diagonalizable, oftentimes before you even proceed to find its eigenvectors and eigenvalues. All right, so the basic idea that what we're trying to do is giving a square matrix A, we want to find a matrix C that will convert it into a simpler matrix, one that's diagonal, so that it's only non-zero entries occur along that main diagonal. So effectively what this matrix C is doing, it's converting A into a diagonal matrix. And I'll show you on Wednesday some applications of that. But the way this worked is because if we write a matrix in terms of its columns, there's two multiplication identities at play. So let's take a matrix. Arbitrary n by n matrix, but let me express it as a bunch of column vectors that I've inserted next to one another inside a matrix. What these identities have to do with, and they follow just from the rules of matrix multiplication, is how matrix multiplication acts on another matrix. So in particular, if you multiply your matrix C from the left by an arbitrary matrix A, well, the effect of that is, well, you can compute it directly by taking dot products of the rows of A with the columns of C, but the end result is interpretable as simply the first column of the product is just A times the first column of the second factor C, second column, etc. And by the way, there's also another identity where instead of multiplying a matrix from the left by another matrix A, I could also think of multiplying C from the right by a matrix, but then I don't have such a nice identity. What the analog of this formula is that A acts from the right on a matrix by acting on its rows rather than its columns. So there is an analogous identity for multiplying C from the right, but instead of writing the result in terms of the columns, you write it in terms of the row, but it's an analogous identity. There's also a second identity. Here I am multiplying C from the right by a matrix, but I'm restricting attention to when D is diagonal. And when D is diagonal, if I multiply a matrix that's specified in terms of columns from the right by a diagonal matrix, the effect of that is just multiplying the original columns of C by a corresponding scalar factor. This lambda 1 is going to be the first diagonal entry of D, the one up in this upper right-hand corner. Lambda 2 would be the second one, etc. All right, now these are just identities that follow by specifying a matrix in terms of its columns. And we then argued then, if we're looking for a matrix C, so it's that we can convert A into a diagonal matrix, well, there's a consequence of those two identities. First of all, taking the identity we want and multiplying both sides by the matrix C, and so what's going to happen is that C, C the minus first, is just going to produce a factor of the identity matrix, and what we get is the identity that AC has to equal CD. So anytime we have a matrix that diagonalizes a given matrix A, there's got to be this relationship as well. And now we use these matrix multiplication identities, A times a matrix C consisting of columns C1 through CN, that's exactly this. And on the other hand, C times the diagonal matrix from the right, well, that's going to produce this. And now you compare the two, the equality, column by column, and you see that each column on the right, each column on the left is a scalar multiple of, A times C1 is some scalar multiple of C1, which means that C1 is an eigenvector of A with eigenvalue lambda 1. And in fact, that's true of each of these columns. So if you're going to have an identity like this, one thing that has to happen for this matrix C is its columns have to be eigenvectors of A. And moreover, for this diagonal matrix D, its diagonal entries have to be eigenvalues of the matrix A. And in fact, the eigenvalues are paired with these eigenvectors in the natural way. Lambda 1 is exactly the eigenvalue corresponding to the eigenvector C1. Similarly, lambda 2 would be the eigenvector corresponding to the second eigenvector. All right, so the way you might construct a matrix C that diagonalizes A is you take a bunch of eigenvectors of A, you arrange those as the columns of a matrix. Similarly, you take the corresponding eigenvalue. So lambda 1 is going to be the eigenvalue of A, where B1 is the corresponding eigenvector. And similarly, you order your columns on the right-hand side, and you order the corresponding eigenvalues in exactly the same order. Then this identity is guaranteed. And it would seem that we've then solved the eigenvector eigenvalue problem, but there's one caveat. The identity that we want does imply that AC is equal to DC. However, the opposite implication is not true. AC equals DC does not necessarily mean that C to minus first AC equals D, because that inverse might not exist. And so you may be able to make a matrix of eigenvectors that satisfy this relation, but you won't be able to deduce the desired relation unless that matrix C is in fact invertible. So what I began to talk about on Friday last week were conditions that we could, that would guarantee that those conjugating matrices C are invertible. All right, so let me give you a simple invertibility criteria. I stated this last time, but I want to make it seem much more plausible to you. Remember that the way you calculate an inverse of a matrix A, let's call it C, so it's even more explicit, the way you would find C to minus first is you would row reduce C adjoined with I, and if you get the identity matrix here, then what happens on, what happens on the right-hand side ends up being the inverse, or you get something else. Something else, and C to minus first does not exist. All right, so that's the calculation by which we originally learned how to find inverses of matrices. I also want to remind you of how to find a basis for a column space of a matrix C. Well, what you would do is you would take C, you would row reduce to its a reduced row echelon form, or even further to reduced row echelon form. To a reduced row echelon form, and let's call that C double prime. Well, the way you can find a basis for the column space of this matrix is you look at where the pivots live, and then the columns of the original matrix C corresponding to the columns of this reduced row echelon form. So a C double prime that have pivots. Those are your basis vectors for the column space of the original matrix. So that calculation has been known for a while, and we're going to use these two facts to prove this lemma. So if C is invertible, then it can be row reduced the identity matrix. That's this calculation, essentially. But then if the identity matrix is a row echelon form of C, then that means the row echelon form of C has a pivot in every column, right? Because that's the identity matrix. You always have a pivot along that main diagonal. Every column is going to have a pivot. Well, that means that when we go back, if we want to find a basis for the column space, every column of the original matrix is going to be a basis vector. This is the rule by which we find basis vectors for the column space. Well, that just means that every column vector of the original matrix C, since it's a basis vector, they must all be linearly independent. A basis is a set of vectors that's one, linearly independent, and two, capable of reaching every point in the space they generate. Well, we find a basis for C, and it turns out if C is row reducible to the identity matrix, that every column of C can be used as a basis vector for the column space. That means that all the columns of C are linearly independent. And then back, so what we need in order for our matrix that converts a given matrix A into a diagonal matrix, we need an invertible matrix. C is going to be invertible if its columns are linearly independent. On the previous slide, we saw that C also has to consist of eigenvectors of A. And so putting this all together, if you have a square matrix A, it's going to be diagonalizable if and only if you have enough linearly independent eigenvectors. Since every column of the matrix C, that set of columns has to be linearly independent. Since you're going to make the columns from eigenvectors of the matrix A, you're going to have n linearly independent eigenvectors in order to construct an invertible matrix. All right, so that's essentially our criterion. But now, and that much I covered last week, what I'm going to focus on today is ways to spotting whether or not a given matrix has enough linearly independent eigenvectors to construct that diagonalizing matrix C. Okay, so the first way I'll try to answer this question is by reviewing a little bit more of our eigenvector eigenvalue calculations. Remember, if you have a square matrix A, you can calculate its eigenvalues always by looking at the characteristic polynomial, and which is just the determinant of A minus a parameter lambda times the identity matrix. And because of the fundamental theorem of calculus, any polynomial of degree n, such as this, is always going to be factorizable in terms of linear polynomials, though potentially these offsets from lambda in each factor, they could be complex numbers. But they're anyway going to be the eigenvectors of the matrix A, because they will be roots of the condition that this characteristic polynomial is equal to zero. All right, so that gave us a certain multiplicity that we can attach to a given eigenvalue. This number M1, the number of powers of the factor lambda minus R1 in the characteristic polynomial, that's known as the algebraic multiplicity of the given eigenvalue. And one thing to note about this, because this is for an n by n matrix, the characteristic polynomial is always a polynomial of degree n. Well, that means that these factors, actually these multiplicities, are going to have to sum up to the size of the matrix, because both have to be polynomials of the same degree. All right, so those are the algebraic multiplicities. They're related to the factorization of the characteristic polynomial. And that factorization you want anyway, because you want to find the actual eigenvalues. But distinct from these algebraic multiplicities, we had another kind of multiplicity. And that was, how many linearly independent eigenvectors do you have with a given eigenvalue? What we do is this set here is the set of all vectors inside Rn, such that the vectors are eigenvalues of the matrix A with the given eigenvalue Ri. So it's the number of linearly independent basis vectors, or equivalently the dimension of this null space, or equivalently the number of free parameters when you row reduce this matrix to reduce row echelon form and you count the number of columns without pivots. So that's how you calculate these numbers. Oh, sorry, this should be a subscript there, because I get one geometric multiplicity for each eigenvalue. All right, now the thing I want to point out here, I didn't really remark or make a strong comment about this at the time we were discussing geometric multiplicities, but what these geometric multiplicities are doing is they're counting the number of linearly independent eigenvectors in each eigenspace, right? Once you have a basis, then you have a fixed set of linearly independent vectors. The number of those is the dimension of your subspace. So in fact, what these geometric multiplicities are doing, they're counting the dimension of the eigenspaces associated with eigenvectors, or equivalently, they're counting the number of linearly independent eigenvectors in each eigenspace. So to diagonalize a matrix, to get a matrix C that will diagonalize A, it needs to have an inverse. In order to have an inverse, we have to have enough linearly independent vectors to use as columns, so that matrix will reduce to the identity matrix. Well, what this geometric multiplicity is doing is it's doing a sort of a piecemeal approach to the general problem. In order to diagonalize A, I need a total, if A is n by n, I need a total of n linearly independent eigenvectors so I can create that matrix C. Well, these geometric multiplicities count the number of linearly independent eigenvectors in each eigenspace. So to get the total number of linearly independent eigenvectors, what you have to do is add up all these geometric multiplicities. You count them up eigenspace by eigenspace. All right, now, those algebraic and geometric multiplicities also had some combinatorial identities. First one was that the algebraic multiplicity, the number of factors of lambda minus Ri that occurs in the characteristic polynomial, that has to be at least one, otherwise you wouldn't have an eigenvalue. But in fact, it turns out that the geometric multiplicity is bounded between this lower bound, and it possibly could be as large as the algebraic multiplicity, but in general, it lies somewhere in between. The other thing, and I already pointed this out on the last slide, when you write down this factorization, both sides have to be polynomials of degree n, which means these numbers m1 through mk, they have to add up to n. So what this is going to mean, these two identities, if the algebraic multiplicities always add up to n, but notice if just one of these guys is less than the corresponding algebraic multiplicity, the sum of these guys will not add up to n anymore. I mean, if the equality is true, the algebraic multiplicities are all equal to the geometric multiplicities are all equal to the algebraic multiplicities, then I can just substitute in and I see that I have enough linearly independent eigenvectors. These guys are counting the number of linearly independent eigenvectors in each eigenspace. When we sum over all possible eigenspaces, that's when we get the total number of linearly independent eigenvectors. But I can't just substitute mu for m here, because they're not necessarily equal. They could be less than. And if any one of these numbers is less than the corresponding algebraic multiplicity, that means whatever these add up to is going to be less than n. All right, so the statement then is an n by n matrix with a given list of eigenvalues is going to be diagonalizable only if we have a total of n linearly independent eigenvectors. For that to happen, it suffices that one of these geometric multiplicities is less than the corresponding algebraic multiplicity. All right, so the same argument. It's just because when I add up all these geometric multiplicities, I get the maximum number of linearly independent eigenvectors. But if any one of these numbers is less than the corresponding algebraic multiplicities, these numbers will no longer add up to n. And I won't have enough linearly independent eigenvectors to construct an invertible matrix C. All right, now there's one special case that's fairly common and easy to handle. Suppose we have K, suppose the eigenvectors of the eigenvalues of A are all distinct. So that means that two eigenvalues for different indices 1 through k, we have a different index here, then the eigenvalue is also different. Then the corresponding eigenvectors are always going to be linearly independent. All right, so here I'm considering any set of eigenvectors for which the corresponding eigenvalues are different from one another. I'm going to only prove this for the case when I only have two eigenvectors having two different eigenvalues. In the more general case, we have an arbitrary number of eigenvectors corresponding to distinct eigenvalues. That's done by induction. But you'll see the basic problem here. Suppose B1 and B2 are eigenvectors of a matrix A. That means we'll have A, B1, is some multiple of B1. And A, B2 is going to equal some multiple of B2. All right. I'm going to see if what conditions, if these guys were linearly independent, see if they're linearly independent or not. So let's take a linear combination of these two vectors, set it equal to the zero vector, and see whether or not these coefficients, x1 and x2, whether we can have a non-solution of this equation where x1 and x2 are not equal to zero. Well, in fact, I'm going to assume that. I'm going to assume that, say, x1 is not equal to zero, and then this equation will allow me to express one of the eigenvectors in terms of the other eigenvector. And now, since B1 is to be an eigenvector of A with eigenvalue lambda 1, we'll have AB1 is equal to lambda B1. But now, if B1 and B2 are linearly dependent, then I can replace B1 by the scalar multiple of B2. And then this is just a scalar multiple, so I can bring the factor, the matrix factor, past the scalar multiplication, let it attack B2 directly. When A hits B2, B2 is an eigenvalue, eigenvector of A with eigenvalue lambda 2. So we're going to kick out lambda 2 B2. And now I'll just reverse the order of factors. This guy here can be again identified as B1. And so now the extreme sides say that lambda times z1 has to equal lambda 2 times z1. But I know by hypothesis that B1 and B2 correspond to different eigenvalues. So my hypothesis here is that lambda 1 does not equal lambda 2. So this can't happen. If this were 3 and this were 4, it would say that 3 times B1 is equal to 4 times D1. That can't happen unless B1 itself is 0. But eigenvectors, we always exclude the trivial eigenvector corresponding to the 0 vector. Eigenvectors are non-zero vectors. So in fact, this is a contradiction. All right, so that shows you if you have two different eigenvectors, but they have different eigenvalues, they're necessarily linearly independent of one another. Okay, so now we got a theorem. Suppose we have a n by n matrix, and it has a total of n distinct eigenvalues. Well, that's going to mean that all these multiplicities are equal to 1. So in fact, your eigenvalues are going to be 1 through lambda n. The corresponding characteristic polynomial is going to be exactly, I'll write it this way, lambda minus lambda 1, dot, 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 lambda minus lambda n. So I'm sorry for the sort of funny notation here. When I'm putting subscripts on lambda, I'm meaning I've got specific numbers that are going to be eigenvalues of the matrix A. Here, lambda is a parameter. It's a variable in this polynomial. And these are offsets that I've previously labeled as R, rather than confusing you with the variable with the sort of corresponding root. But what's going to happen here is that all these mi's are going to equal 1, but we know the mu i's are bounded between 1 and mi. Now, if the mi are all equal 1, that's going to mean that these geometric multiplicities are also all equal to 1. And so what we have is the sum of the mu i's, I equals 1 to n, is going to equal summation I equals 1 to n. They're all equal to 1, and we're going to get n. We are going to have enough linearly independent eigenvectors to create that conjugating matrix C that will diagonalize A. But one thing is not clear, or wasn't clear up to this point, was whether or not all the corresponding eigenvectors were actually linearly independent of one another. But now we've just proved that if you have different eigenvalues, the corresponding eigenvectors are linearly independent. So in this situation, where we have n distinct eigenvalues, we're also going to have n linearly independent eigenvectors. And the diagonalization construction, where C goes to that first eigenvector as the first column, second eigenvector as the second column, last eigenvector as the last column, these are all going to be linearly independent. So B1 through Bn are linearly independent. And so C is invertible. And then C minus first, AC is going to in fact diagonalize the matrix A. All right, so one quick way of determining or seeing that a matrix can be diagonalized is simply to calculate its eigenvalues and verify that you get a total of n distinct eigenvalues. Okay, so let me do some examples. In this first example, let's work through it. The question I want to pose for this 2x2 matrix is, can I diagonalize it? Oh, there it is. So what we'll do is we'll look at the corresponding characteristic polynomial first. The zeros of this polynomial are going to, of course, be the eigenvalues of the original matrix A. Now we calculate the determinant of A minus lambda times I. It turns out to be a perfect square and it has a unique root. Lambda has to equal 1. So we only have one eigenvector. We need two linearly independent eigenvectors. So diagonalizability is not guaranteed because all our multiplicities are not equal to 1. Rather, we have a double root, lambda equal to 1. So we think of there being two factors here. Because the algebraic multiplicities are not equal to 1, we have non-distinct eigenvalues. And the preceding theorem, this theorem here, does not imply, because effectively our two eigenvalues corresponding to the two factors are the same, lambda equals 1. This is lambda equals 1 times lambda equals 1. All right, so we only have one eigenvalue. Because of that, diagonalizability is not guaranteed. Let's go ahead and calculate the lambda equals 1 eigenspace, because it could be that that lambda equals 1 eigenspace is two-dimensional, in which case, just that one eigenspace would give us enough eigenvectors. But if we examine that, move the calculation down a little bit, if we actually go ahead and calculate that lambda equals 1 eigenspace, well, we calculate this matrix, and the idea is to calculate its null space. So we row reduce to reducible echelon form. We look at this matrix, it's the reduced row echelon form of a coefficient matrix. And the equations correspond to it are going to be 0 times x1 plus 1 times x2 is equal to 0, and 0 is equal to 0. So the solution set corresponding to the homogeneous linear system with this coefficient matrix is just the span of a single vector. In other words, I only have one eigenspace because I only have one eigenvalue. That one eigenspace only has one linearly independent vector inside it. And so I'm only going to get one linearly independent eigenvector for the matrix A. I need two to construct a diagonalizing matrix C. And so the conclusion is that there is no matrix C that actually is going to be, that will diagonalize A, because I can't make an invertible matrix out of the using only the eigenvectors of A. I don't have enough eigenvectors to get an invertible matrix. Okay, so the conclusion here is the original matrix A is not diagonalizable because it doesn't have enough linearly independent eigenvectors. But we've seen that by, in fact, explicitly finding all the linear independent eigenvectors we could find. All right, so let me do a more complicated example, sort of at the other extreme. Here, I'll look at a 3x3 matrix, and I'll ask the same question. Is this matrix diagonalizable? So we look at its characteristic polynomial. I calculate it. It works out to be this polynomial. I guess you'd have to do something like a cofactor expansion along that second row in order to complete this calculation, but it ends up to being a cubic polynomial that is factorizable. You at least see that common factor of lambda in each term, but then they, once you remove a power of lambda, you, the quadratic factor that remains factorizes like that, and you see that we have three distinct eigenvalues, lambda equals 0, or lambda equals negative 1, or lambda equal 2. All right, now we are in the situation where we can apply the theorem that says if you have, for an n by n matrix, if you have n distinct eigenvalues, then necessarily you're going to have enough linearly independent eigenvectors, because for each of these distinct eigenvalues, you're going to have a linearly independent eigenvector. So add them up, and you get three linearly independent eigenvectors. That's enough eigenvectors to create an invertible matrix C. All right, so that's how quickly I can determine whether or not a matrix can be diagonalized. Let's go ahead and diagonalize it. That just will allow me to review the computation. The first thing you need to do is find the three linearly independent eigenvectors. We'll do that by extracting from each eigenspace a corresponding basis vector. So we first look at the zero eigenspace. That's going to correspond to the null space of A minus the eigenvalue times the identity matrix, or this matrix. The next step is to take this coefficient matrix and reduce it to its reduced row echelon form. That's here. What happened in between was row reduction. And what I've got here is the reduced row echelon form. All right, then once you get the reduced row echelon form of a coefficient matrix of a homogeneous linear system, effectively AX is equal to zero, then what you do is you go back and you convert back to equations and try to write down the solution, and the solution set is a hyperplane. And what one finds in this particular example is you're going to have x1 plus x2 is equal to zero. That's going to actually produce this vector. This one is just saying the third component has to equal zero. So I basically have a two conditions on a three-dimensional vector. I'm left with a one-dimensional span. All right, so I have exactly one basis vector for the lambda equals zero eigenspace. All right, so, and there it is. That vector here that generates the entire null space, that's what we use as the eigenvector corresponding to the given eigenvalue. We have two more eigenvalues, and so what we want to do now is use those eigenvalues to find corresponding basis vectors. So similar for the preceding case, we subtract the eigenvalue from the diagonal entries of A, yielding this matrix, then we row reduce the coefficient matrix to reduce row echelon form, and we try to write down the solution vectors. In this case, what's going to happen is the first component has to equal zero, coming from that line, and that x2 is going to have to equal the negative x3. That's why those components pop out. We have only one basis vector for the entire solution set, and so that one basis, that one vector is actually going to be our basis. So now we've got an eigenvector corresponding to the eigenvalue minus one. And we have one last eigenvalue, which lambda equals two. Same calculation. You subtract two from the diagonal elements of A, you get a matrix that you then row reduce to reduce row echelon form, and you then endeavor to write down the solution vector. Let me remind you of this calculation. What you do, once you get to the matrix in reduced row echelon form, you write down the corresponding equation. So I have x1 plus 0 times x2 minus 3 halves x3 is equal to 0. Second row is telling me that x2 minus 1 half x3 is equal to 0. And last row is telling me 0 is equal to 0. We then, after looking at these equations, and decide some of these variables are fixed and some variables are free, we use the column that doesn't contain the pivot to be the free, correspond to the free parameter. And so these equations become x1 is equal to 3 halves x3, and x2 is equal to 1 half x3. That expresses the fixed variables in terms of the free variables. We write down a solution vector, 3 halves x3, 1 half x3, x3, and then we expand in terms of the free parameter to get that basis vector. So that would be 3 halves, 1 half, and 1. Right, so that's why, that's where that vector popped out of. That's the full calculation. And what we see is, again, we have a single basis vector for the entire eigenspace. What you can often do, once you have a basis vector, is you can scale or multiply it, and you'll get another basis vector. So here, all I've done between here is I've gotten rid of these fractions by taking this basis vector, multiplying it by 2 to get rid of the fractions in the integers in the denominators to get a simpler vector. And I'll call the basis vector for the lambda equals 2 eigenspace, I'll use this vector, 3, 1, and 2. All right, so in this example of a 3x3 matrix, we first of all found all its eigenvalues, and we found that there were 3 distinct eigenvalues. If we have a 3x3 matrix, that was already enough to tell us that the matrix would be diagonalizable. Then what I did is I proceeded to diagonalize the matrix C. Well, we're about to anyway. I solved the eigenvector eigenvalue problem for the given matrix. I had, for the eigenvalue 0, I had an eigenvector. For the eigenvalue minus 1, I have an eigenvector. And for an eigenvalue 2, I have yet another eigenvector. Because these correspond to distinct eigenvalues, the corresponding eigenvectors are linearly independent. That means when I use these vectors as columns, not only will they be eigenvectors of the matrix A, they're going to be linearly independent columns as well. So this matrix C is going to be invertible. That makes it possible to actually take the natural identity where A times C is equal to C times D. That identity can be inverted. Well, we simply multiply it by the inverse of C, and we get the identity we want. We get a matrix that converts the given matrix into a diagonal matrix. How did I know, without actually doing this computation, computing the inverse of C, multiplying it by A, and then multiplying by C again, how do I know that the resulting diagonal matrix is exactly this matrix? Well, that follows from the fact that when you do diagonalize a matrix C, what's going to correlate between your diagonalizing matrix C and the diagonal matrix that results is that the entries along this diagonal matrix, along the main diagonal, they have to be exactly the eigenvalues of corresponding to the corresponding columns of the matrix C. So since I use an eigenvalue 0 corresponding to this column, I'll write down that column, but then for the eigenvalue, I'll use 0. In the second column, I'll use this column vector. It's the eigenvector of A with eigenvalue minus 1. So I'll put it in the second slot, but simultaneously, what I have to do is put the right eigenvalue in the matrix D. So second slot, second diagonal element. And then the third column, I grab the third eigenvalue and use that as the last diagonal element of the diagonal matrix D. So that's how it works. All right, so let me close today's lecture with an example that I'm not going to prove, but it's pretty common in physical applications. A matrix A is said to be symmetric. First of all, it has to be a square matrix. It's going to be symmetric if it's equal to its transpose. So another way of saying that is that the entry in the ith row and jth column of the matrix A is exactly the same thing as the entry in the jth row and ith column. You're going to have a certain reflection symmetry. If you have A, let's put it in the ith row here, and jth column, so this would be column I, row I, column J, row I. Well, somewhere down here might be row J, and there might be a corresponding column I here, what would have to happen, that these two entries are actually going to be on opposite sides of that main diagonal. They have to be equal in order to be in order for the transpose be the same. Or in other words, if I take the rows of the matrix A and I form a new matrix using the rows of A as columns, I'll get exactly the transpose matrix. And what I'm saying is then the transpose is the same as the original matrix. Anyway, these sorts of matrix occur quite frequently in physical applications. And what's nice about them is, first of all, they're always diagonalizable. And second of all, this is even nicer, is their eigenvalues are always real numbers. What's going to happen in this case is that when you calculate the characteristic polynomial of a symmetric matrix, you get a polynomial that you get a polynomial that only has real solutions when you set it equal to zero. You're not going to get something like PA of lambda. It's not going to equal something like x squared plus one, which never equals, maybe lambda squared. It's not going to equal something like this, because this is only has roots when lambda is equal to the square root of negative one, or plus or minus I, the pure imaginary number. In the case of a symmetric multiplication, this complication of having to leap up into complex numbers never occurs. That's really, turns out to be really important for a number of physical applications. That means, for example, when you calculate the moments of inertia for rotational body, those moments of inertia, they actually turn out to be eigenvalues of a particular matrix. Those moments of inertia turn out to be real numbers, not complex numbers. That would be vital to the physical interpretation. But also, if you ever go as far as to do things like quantum mechanics and the like, finding the energy levels of a hydrogen atom is tantamount to diagonalizing a certain matrix. And what's important is that matrix turns out to be symmetric, and so the eigenvalues of your energy operator are all real numbers, which means your energies are real. They're not complex numbers. Okay, so I think I'll stop here today. What I'm going to do on Wednesday is I want to show you a nice application of having the ability to diagonalize a matrix. What I'll show you is that, in fact, we can solve differential equations, systems of differential equations, pretty readily if we can diagonalize a certain matrix. And I'll be able to do so without doing any much at all about the theory of differential equations. I just want you to know how to solve the differential equation for the exponential function. And then from that, we'll be able to solve systems of differential equations that actually govern a large number of applications in finance and biology, chemistry, et cetera. Okay, so I'll let you guys go today, and tomorrow we'll do an application of diagonalization. Yeah.
So I missed the part. Whenever you found the eigenvectors, you ended up flipping the sign of this entry and that entry. Why did that happen?
Well, okay, so when you write out the equation, you'll have x1 plus x2 is equal to 0, right? Mm-hmm. But now you want to move the free parameter to the opposite side. That's where that minus sign comes in. So x1 minus x2. X1 plus X2 is equal to 0,
yeah.
Or X1 is equal to minus X2. Mm-hmm. So in the solution vector, X1 is going to be minus X2, and mm-hmm. X2 is going to equal X2.
Yeah. So on yours, you got to this part, and then you had a 1 minus 1, 0. And then your final one, you ended up, whenever you're creating C, the values were changed right here.
Oh, did I? Yeah, I should have used that one.
But, okay. Would it be the same result?
Yeah, it would be the, I mean, but it's kind of a coincidence.
Okay.
Yeah, it would be the same result because, at any rate, this is, even though I switched the sign, it's still an eigenvector with eigenvalue zero.
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea is you take an eigenvector with the correct eigenvalue and you correlate eigenvectors with their eigenvalues.
Okay.
And so any one of those columns could be multiplied by any number and it would still work.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Put another way, there's lots of eigenvectors, but what we've been doing is grabbing basis vectors. And so every other eigenvector is just going to be a scalar multiple of that same vector. So you just work with one basis vector rather than the entire set of eigenvectors.
Okay.